From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You know, it's in the show, like, running from who you are is hard, especially if you have a limp. Like, I really believe that. Like, you can't, honey. Like, cerebral palsy will always catch up. She's slow, but she gets there.
For years, Ryan O'Connell was in the closet, not because he's gay, which he is, but because he was ashamed of having cerebral palsy. His cover? He'd been hit by a car, which was true. But eventually, that lie took a toll. Today, we're revisiting our conversation with O'Connell. He tells us about the four-year struggle to find a home for his autobiographical comedy series, Special, which is now nominated for 4 Emmys in the short-form category. But first, on an all-new News Banter, why Martin Scorsese's The Irishman may not be coming to a theater near you. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. I was off the grid in the wilds of West Virginia. So we'll talk about Netflix. We never talk about Netflix. We'll talk about Netflix because Netflix constantly commands our attention. This time we're looking at Netflix cruising into awards season with a big, big batch of movies. I think the highest profile is Martin Scorsese's mob movie, The Irishman. I almost feel like it's redundant to say Martin Scorsese's mob movie, although he has done not mob movies. But this is a movie that is, you know, the kind of thing that the film world, the adult, you know, art house type of film world is like, of course, this is going to get a wide release, isn't it? I will note that this movie cost about $160 million. That was so rich that Paramount said no. Paramount had been very much in business with Martin Scorsese. And for Paramount to let this movie go, you just know that they felt there was zero choice. Netflix stepped in, as Netflix does with those megabucks. And now the question has been, will it get that wide release? And the answer is, it's not going to. It'll get some release, but the theaters are still not willing to play the Netflix game of only putting it out there a little bit for a couple of 3 weeks, maybe, and then pulling it back and streaming it. The big theater chains are not having it.
No, and this is becoming an annual event where everyone speculates about which big Netflix movie will get that big wide commercial release in theaters. And the answer is the theater owners don't want it. And they don't want it because Netflix is slowly killing their business, they believe. And if they endorse this, it's just going to open the floodgates and everybody is going to go and put their movies on their streaming service a couple of weeks after they're in theaters. And the value proposition of going to the movies is going to be down. Now, you can argue whether that's a correct or incorrect statement, but the fact of the matter is Netflix has 10 films that they're going to put in theaters this fall for various levels of theatrical exposure. And they're doing this in an environment where the big theater chains are not letting them put their movies in their theaters. So they're having to go to these smaller chains, New York, Los Angeles, big cities, where there is an indie film appetite. And they're doing it for awards. They want awards and they want to court filmmakers. And that's what filmmakers want. They want to be able to see their film and have their friends and family see their film in theaters.
Yeah, they really want the wide release, of course. Now, last year, Netflix did very well with Roma, but they didn't snag the Best Picture Oscar that some people thought they were going to. You can argue, and I know you did just when we were talking earlier off mic, Roma's a tough sell in a way, not only because it was from a streaming service, but because it was in a foreign language. It was a period piece. It was black and white. It was long. It was meditative. All of those things, it still, many people thought, was a masterpiece, and it did very well. But then again, they didn't get the Best Picture. So I'm saying, I would think filmmakers are going to watch to see how much resistance the Academy has to rewarding these films. And I don't know, is it going to break down over time? Because I think there was resistance. You know, Steven Spielberg kind of spoke up and said, I don't really know. This isn't really right. It's not really a movie if it doesn't play in movie theaters in a certain way. Then he got some blowback because people said it was insensitive to young filmmakers, people of color who don't have the same opportunity to command that wide release that a Steven Spielberg or normally a Martin Scorsese would. You know, do things just shift over now and people start saying, who cares if it's Netflix? Nobody else was going to make The Irishman. Or do they still have resistance?
Well, that's a good point, is that Netflix basically saved this movie for Martin Scorsese and allowed him to make it with this elaborate de-aging process that he has for his lead stars, De Niro, Al Pacino, Joe Pesci. You know, it's an interesting question. This is a much more commercial, mainstream typical Oscar bait type movie than something like Roma. And, you know, this is the type of movie that does make money in theaters. And if you look at Scorsese's last big star-driven commercial movie, The Wolf of Wall Street, that did $400 million in theaters. And for them to not be able to expand this film worldwide is a hit for Netflix. They knew it going into it. They're going to try to, you know, salvage it with this awards campaign and get subscribers who say, you know what, Martin Scorsese's got a movie on Netflix. I really need to see that if I want to be in the Oscar conversation. That's their whole model. That's why they have 60 people working on awards campaigns at Netflix. That's all they do is try to win awards. It's a huge investment because they see the value proposition of distinguishing their content as premium quality in a sea of shows and movies online.
I will say $160 million does clear the sinuses for this kind of movie, I would say. But
that's only what they reported. Right? I mean, I've heard it's much higher than that.
Oh, my God. So let me swivel to Venice is underway, the Venice Film Festival. It's award, you know, it's going to be Venice, Toronto, Telluride. It's all happening in a compressed period. Netflix, as we are speaking, really just had this Scarlett Johansson, Adam Driver movie, Marriage Story from Noah Baumbach debut at Venice. And the reviews coming out, early reviews are absolute raves. I mean, it could be that this thing is actually, you know, any one of these things could be the movie, or who knows, Netflix could gobble up any number of Oscar Best Picture slots, but this thing is supposed to be great. However, Venice has got a lot of controversy going on. The film festival director, Alberto Barbera, invited Roman Polanski to premiere his latest movie, An Officer and a Spy. And on top of that, Nate Parker, who has his first film since Birth of the Nation. And both of them have been alleged to have engaged in misconduct. In case of Roman Polanski, I'll point out there's no argument here. He drugged and raped and sodomized a 13-year-old. And he has just gone public at this thing at the festival, you know, in a pre-festival interview, I guess, talking about how outraged he is, that how dare people judge him and they don't know the facts. Well, I know quite a bit about the facts and they are terrible. So between these two things, and let me just say briefly, Nate Parker, you know, Nate Parker was accused to have assaulted a woman in college. It's a terrible, tragic story. And the problem, again, for Nate Parker, not so much that he was convicted of anything, which he wasn't, but that he couldn't just gracefully say, this was a terrible thing that I did in my life and I'm atoning. He had this problem that a lot of guys trying to deal with maybe Me Too type of allegations or assault allegations, maybe allegations that maybe there could be room for some recovery, they just try to brazen it out. And so these two guys at Venice, it's kind of a bad look, you know, completely tone deaf is how it was described in our publication, by Melissa Silverstein, who is the founder of Women in Hollywood.
Yeah, and the Polanski thing is interesting because he's so defiant. I mean, the Academy kicked him out and then he sued the Academy trying to get back in. You know, he's not going to attend the festival because he can't, because if he leaves Switzerland, he could be extradited to the U.S. to face charges here. So he's going to Skype in. And it's an interesting dynamic that is playing out because the Me Too movement is a different thing in Europe. They have different attitudes towards this kind of stuff, and the movement has not been as pervasive as it has been in the U.S. So we've seen things like Woody Allen getting a premiere at the Deauville Film Festival, where he can't even get a U.S. distributor for his new movie. And we're seeing Venice take these two very controversial filmmakers and give them these prominent slots at a prominent film festival. And it really creates a clash with what you see going on in the U.S., especially given that the filmmakers in the Venice Film Festival this year are overwhelmingly male, whereas most film festivals have made efforts over the past few years to be more inclusive, to invite more female and people of color filmmakers, and Venice really hasn't done that.
Yeah, I mean, like, just say whatever your standards are, child rape to me just is outside the bounds of anything. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the Netflix comedy series special, Ryan O'Connell plays a version of himself. Ryan Hayes is a gay man beset by millennial angst, who also has cerebral palsy. Early in the first episode, his physical therapist, played by Brandon Potter, catches Ryan ogling one of the other trainers.
Hey, focus. Save that for Grindr.
I love that you think I have enough self-esteem to be on Grindr. What would my profile even say? I'm gay and disabled. But I promise not to drool on you until the third date.
As O'Connell did in real life, his character in the show finds some writing success at a website that runs on clicks generated from deeply personal first-person blog posts. Again, as in real life, the fictional Ryan hides the fact that he has cerebral palsy. Instead, soon after he's hired, he takes advantage of a moment when his boss, played by Marla Mindell, finds out that he was hit by a car. Yes, as O'Connell was in real life.
It all makes so much sense now. Your inability to open mail, your sad limp.
Oh, my limp is actually
Are you ever going to get better? Or is this just, like, it for you?
Yeah. This is it for me. All from getting hit by a car.
Wow. Everybody, come hug Ryan. He was hit by a car and now he's a weird, sad limp forever.
O'Connell wrote about being gay and disabled and staying in the closet about his cerebral palsy in his 2015 memoir, I'm Special and Other Lies We Tell Ourselves. When he then started pitching his book as a TV series, he didn't envision himself playing himself.
He said, I wanted to be Nora Ephron, not Meg Ryan.
Yeah. When we initially went out with the pitch in 2015, I was not attached to star. And I think it's because I wasn't an actor. I mean, I'd never acted before. So everyone passed on that pitch. And then we went to this digital branch of Warner Brothers, Stage 13, and they were doing short form content. And I always thought that they had me play myself due to budget. But I remember my exec called me the other day and was like, babe, that's like not what it was. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, I thought you were an actor. Like, I just assumed you were. And so I was like, oh, he'll just play himself. And then halfway through, I was like, wait, he's never acted before. So then I had to screen test for the role of myself. And honey, I got it. Valerie Cherish, I got it. Now, having gone through the process, I feel like I always actually wanted to act. And I always was like a natural performer. But I didn't give myself permission to want that because I didn't think that that was a feasible life path for me. And I so strongly identified as a writer. And I thought being an actor like wasn't chic or something. I don't know. I'm now fully embracing the fact that I'm an actor, that I do like to act, and I'm really actually happy that it worked out this way and that no one else played me.
Well, there is a bit of a sticky wicket, right? Because you would not want, I'm not even sure of my terminology, a not disabled person playing a
Never. And like, you know, our cup doesn't run over with like gay disabled actors. I mean, there are a few of them, but
yeah, I'm actually starting to think, well, what if it was a straight disabled actor playing gay?
No,
no,
I don't want that.
No to that too.
I don't want that. You always have to give jobs to the people that don't get the jobs.
Right.
It's not that complicated for me. Like gay actors have a harder time than straight actors. That's just the way it is. So I would always want to give parts to gay people playing gay roles. So yeah, it would have to be a gay disabled actor, which I know of one other one, and I'm sure there are more, but it definitely is a limited pool.
Right. So, you know, it sort of worked out that way.
Yes.
I mean, this did in fact arise from you doing blog posts like your character in the show. And blog posts beget a book.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
What are
the
odds?
Such a world we live in. I was writing blog posts that were, excuse me, it's going to get nauseous in here. They were going viral. And so I had some book agents kind of peek their head out and be like, okay. So I ended up signing with Simon & Schuster, but the book that I ended up selling them was not the book that I ended up writing. I ended up selling this book that was all about being a millennial, which like sounds totally gross now, but in 2011 was actually considered like groundbreaking. So I sold the book, and at the time I was closeted about my disability. I had gotten hit by a car at 20, and I moved to
New
York.
Okay, wait, we got to stop for a second here because this is one of the striking things to me and makes me feel some hope for tomorrow.
Yeah.
That your character is out as far as being gay. That's not even the thing.
Oh, yeah, honey.
But you're actually, nobody would think you could even be in the closet about a disability. That's
no,
crazy.
I know. Well, it's all about disabled privilege. Like, I have a mild case. So, like, you can dress her up, you can dress her down. Like, you know what I mean? So, when I moved to New York, everyone assumed my limp was from my car accident.
You had a real, I mean, you
I had a real,
I want to
yes,
be clear. There is a car accident in the show, but there is a real car accident that is far more serious than the accident.
Way more
in the
serious.
Show.
Yes. I got hit by a car that was going 45 miles per hour. It just clipped me. If I had hit me head on, I would have died. But it just clipped my elbow and it created such pressure in the elbow that the oxygen supply of my hand got cut off. So I started losing hand function. And then I had like 4 surgeries. Then I was in the hospital for about a month. And then I had a couple more surgeries over the span of 2 years. It was gnarly. I was one-handed for about a year. And I couldn't
I read
really...
somewhere that it was the, like, your better side was not the side.
Yeah, of course. It hits the side that's not affected by CP. Like, of course it does, honey.
Of course.
So now I'm just left with two meh sides. Yeah. It, so
permanently,
anyway,
really?
Permanently meh. Yeah, mm-hmm. permanently meh. But, you know, look, I feel like I was more an advantage to deal with this accident because I had grown up disabled. So I was kind of used to things being taken away from me. Like, if anyone knows how to compensate, it's me. And so I think I was just better prepared to learn how to deal with having a hand that just is half function is gone. But it was pretty intense. And in the show, it's really just like he gets
played
hit by a car and he's fine.
Because
it's like you don't have the room to have that be the story. But it really happened. You know, I moved to New York and yeah, people assumed my limbs from an accident. And I never
really...
You're
like a true writer. You used the material to get tell your story, even though the story wasn't
I know.
True.
I mean, yeah. it's... I mean, it, by the way, it didn't even strike me as that... crazy until I remember coming out about it and people were so like thought that was so interesting that I would think being an accident victim was better than being disabled. But to me, anyone can get hit by a car. It's something that you can understand very easily, whereas I say the word cerebral palsy and it's met with confusion and people don't understand because cerebral palsy can look different literally on everybody. Like the cases can run the gamut from, you know, mild to wild. So like it was just much easier for me to be an accident victim. It was less complicated.
It's relatable.
Yeah. I thought I did a giant life hack. But, like, the reality was I was, like, lying about a large part of who I was, which was creating a lot of emotional problems. Like, you know, it's in the show, like, running from who you are is hard, especially if you have a limp. Like, I really believe that. Like, you can't, honey. Like, cerebral palsy will always catch up. She's slow, but she gets there.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So the coming out was...
So I knew at the time when I sold my book, I was like, I can't write a book about my life and not include my cerebral palsy. Also, I think lying about my cerebral palsy is causing me a lot of harm because at the time I got the book deal, I was addicted to drugs. And I feel like deep down, I kind of knew that I was self-medicating to just deal with the pain. You know, you have these weird insights, I think, even at a young age where your brain kind of like gasps for help and you kind of have to answer that call. And I think that like... And I think that book deal, I was like, if I tell Simon & Schuster this, I'm officially on the hook to come clean about my cerebral palsy and I'm like held accountable. And this is the way to do it. So Simon & Schuster, I told them. And, you know, they were like, great. They were like, really encouraging. They're like, you should write about your disability. So I started writing about my disability, which was really crazy and very strange because I had just totally repressed it for the last like 6 years. Even before I was 20 and got hit by a car, I still did not talk about my disability. Like my disability was never discussed. Like it was just a lot of unpacking through the book. But I still didn't quite understand what a disservice I had done to myself by being closeted about my disability. So I feel like the show is a really great way to explore that in a way that I was not emotionally aware of in the book. You know what I mean?
Well, it's like a therapy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you, at some point, you are pitching this idea for a show.
Yeah.
You didn't want to go to a network.
No, never. Oh my God, no. My agents at the time were like, you have to go to NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox. And I was like, I would rather die. I mean, because I knew that they would probably buy it because it was cerebral palsy and it was gay and it was exciting. And then they would be like, what actually have we bought? We bought a show about a gay disabled person. And then it would just die in development. Or they would buy it and, you know, best case scenario, it would get made. But the script would so not resemble anything that I would want. And so much about the story that I want to tell is tied into sexuality and, like, you know, the desires of a disabled gay person and exploring the fact that they're horny as f- and they like want to have sex and that's okay.
Right.
I couldn't do that on CBS, honey.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
not, maybe like mildly, but not really.
You
could have urges, right?
Yeah. I'd be like, I wish a boy would kiss me. That's it.
That's where it stops.
Like, ah! You know what I mean? Like, so I refused to do that. But then we went to cable and, you know, I had my gay mafia with me, you know, my close friend, Craig Johnson, who's a director. And then John Rigi, who's a producer on 30 Rock and The Comeback. And then Jim Parsons, of course.
Oh, yes. You know, Jim Parsons had read the
book. Jim Parsons optioned it. I had a couple of studios interested, but I loved Jim so much. Like, I'm scared of famous people because they're psychotic. But Jim, so when Jim was like calling, I
mostly.
Was like, I was scared. I was like teeth chattering. Like, I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. And him and his partner, Todd, are seriously the most wonderful, kind, funny people and so smart. There was a couple other studios interested, but I just felt like everyone else was just sort of like very businessy and very Hollywood, and I didn't like that. And I just felt like Jim and Todd hadn't even hired an exec for their production company yet. It was the first thing they ever saw. So there was like a purity to the whole thing. So we were just like a bunch of like weird virgins, like embarking.
I was going to say, you were virgins together.
We were virgins together. And we're like, I don't know. It was a very like unique experience. And it like, we really became close, I think, in a way that isn't normal for the development process, just because we weren't
seasoned.
Don't
try this one at home, kids.
So, but anyway, ended up not selling, which was devastating.
To cable.
Yeah, to cable. I mean,
everybody was like, that's so interesting. We're not buying it.
I think some of them were scared. I think that the landscape was so different. I mean, 2015 was only 4 years ago, but think about it. Like, they were just realizing that, like, women were funny. So gay disability was, like, way down the
right,
list. They were like, what's that?
Right.
We'll deal with that in 4 years, honey. Your time hasn't come yet. Wait in line.
They
really weren't ready for this jelly. But I think everything that I've accomplished in my career or not accomplished, I can really attribute to luck and timing. That really is, you have to be at the right time, the right place, and the zeitgeist has to be ready for it. And they just weren't ready for it in 2015.
Coming up after a short break, Ryan O'Connell tells us why that peach scene in Call Me By Your Name left him still hungry. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with Ryan O'Connell, creator and star of the autobiographical Netflix series Special, a coming-of-age comedy based on O'Connell's experiences as a young gay man with cerebral palsy. The series landed 4 Emmy nominations this year, including for Outstanding Short-Form Series. And for O'Connell himself, he's up for Best Actor in the same category. The 8 episodes of Special are each just about 15 minutes long. O'Connell would like them to be longer, but he still tackles a lot in the time allotted, from dating to sex to a new job to an evolving relationship with his mom, played by Jessica Hecht, who's also Emmy-nominated. She tries to be supportive when her son insists on escaping the suburbs and getting his own apartment in L.A. But when moving day comes, she struggles while watching Ryan struggle to open a taped box.
Ryan, stop. Look, are you sure you want to do this?
Mom, yes, I'm sure.
There's just so much stuff that you don't know how to do. Please, let me do the end table.
No, God, I don't need your help. I can figure it out.
Even normal people ask for help.
Oh, I'm sorry. Am I not normal?
Despite the backing of Big Bang Theory star Jim Parsons, getting Special into production was neither quick nor easy.
So you ended up at this Warner's...
Yeah, this digital branch of Warner Brothers Stage 13, and they were doing short-form content from multi-hyphenates. So I was going to write all the scripts, and I was going to act in them. But I was still working on shows. So I wrote the scripts for Special when I was on Will & Grace, and then Will & Grace wrapped, and then we sent the scripts to Netflix, and Netflix hadn't done short-form before, but they really liked the scripts, and so they just bought them as is.
They can do any form they want.
Exactly.
They're Netflix.
Yeah.
But the one thing that I think I read was that you weren't so sold on doing the 15-minute, the short.
No, I didn't want to do that. Not like in a bratty way. I just am used to half hours, so I couldn't even conceive of 15 minutes. And obviously, like, as a writer, you want the space to tell the story you want to tell, and I just thought it would be too limiting. But I think in the end, it was actually incredible because writing a show, 15 pages, 15 minutes, you learn to become incredibly economical. And you really understand that there's an A story and there's a B story. And that B story is a little bit of a runner. So that's what you have. And you work within those confines. And I think having it stripped down the way it was, it really just teaches you that every single line needs to get you somewhere. It was like a weird boot camp for
me. Discipline.
It was totally disciplined. That being said, season 2 would love 22 minutes to half an hour.
If you're listening.
If we're listening, yeah, totally. And I think that is pretty much loud and clear. So I think if we do return, it will be hopefully in 22 minutes, half hour.
And there were budget constraints as well.
Yeah, yeah. We weren't like, you know, it wasn't a Game of Thrones. Let's put it that way.
You know I'm going to get to the sex.
Oh, sure. Yeah, of course.
Something that I certainly hadn't seen before, but I'm not the only one, which right. is the first time I've seen a rather sweet, gay, deflowering, pretty explicit sex mm-hmm. scene in there.
Yeah.
Did anybody go, uh-uh?
No. My voice, for better or for worse, is incredibly specific, and I'm very clear about what I want. And so anyone that gets into business with me knows what they're getting, and they know that I'm, like, incredibly sex positive, and they know that normalizing gay sex is a big deal for me because I just don't know why it's, like, not shown. Like, I'm really glad that we're talking about the sex scene, but I want to get to a place where it's totally, like, NBD. Like, but we don't live in that space
right
now.
We're not in that world, no.
Which is, like, fine, but I just don't get it. Like, I saw girls, and girls, like, revolutionized the way that I saw sex on TV, but that was straight sex, not gay sex.
Right.
So gay sex is its own can of worms. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, it was just really exciting for me to explore that and do so in a very human and realistic way that's not really played for laughs, but can still be funny and warm and humiliating and comforting all in the same scene.
Yeah, you know? I saw that you felt that it was a bit frustrating in Call Me By Your Name, like they build up, and then cut away.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. I just felt like we had been bait and switched. As gay men, we're like so starving for representation that like we truly like will take any scraps given to us and we'll show up because we're like, yeah, it's like literally been like starving. But I feel like that movie, I mean, here's the thing about Call Me By Your Name. I actually really like that movie and it's incredibly well done, but I couldn't understand why you would show Timothy Chalamet a woman and then have the whole movie be designed around desire between these two men, and then they consummate the relationship and then you just don't show it. I couldn't believe it. We can have a whole movie that's predicated upon gay desire, but we can't actually watch them consummate it. No, that's gone too far. I just couldn't believe it. That really got my goat.
It got your goat. And but your team that you work with at various places, I think I read that it's all gay.
Yeah. I try to live a life that's like very curated where it's like gay men and women. Like I knew like when I was looking for directors that I wanted to work with either a gay guy or a woman. And to me, I'm just really comfortable around gay men and women. And this is a story about a marginalized person. It's very intimate. It's very vulnerable. I just want to feel comfortable with people that get it, that have also been in that space and they know what it's like. And again, it's all about giving jobs to people that don't have them traditionally or giving a chance on someone that ordinarily wouldn't have it. So yeah, wasn't very straight.
That's
the way Mama likes it.
That's the way she likes it. We're hoping for a special season. They haven't told you.
No, they haven't told. But, you know, I will say the response has been so overwhelmingly positive. Like, it's incredible. It's beyond my... You know, it's my first Netflix show, so I don't know what to expect. And so just...
Well, I saw that, you know, that the rap is they throw you out there and you sail off and maybe nobody ever hears of you.
Yeah. Well, it's so crazy because that so has not been my experience with Netflix. Like, they've really championed this show and, like, they give me billboards. Like, I'm an unknown person. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not a star by any means. So, like, the fact that they've invested so much into this show and we're not Grace and Frankie. So it's, like, that goodwill is actually incredible to me. But the response from the show, it's been really validating because I think when I first went out with this show, I was like, I know this sounds like a weird show, but, like, trust me, it's not. It's a fish out of water. It's classic. I'm not reinventing the story wheel here. I'm just showing a character that hasn't been seen on television. So like seeing people from all walks of life, like send me messages and they're not just gay and disabled people. They're people of all kinds. Like it's been just completely like affirming.
Ryan O'Connell is the creator and star of the new Netflix series Special. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.